Welcome to Base Camp for Men. I'm your host, Tony Rizak. This is a show that gives you insights and resources on how to live a more courageous life. We'll be looking at men, the current state of masculinity, and how to create a more inspiring narrative for all men. Welcome, and let's get started. Hello, Base Campers. Hope you're all doing well. Before we get to our excellent interview today, I thought I would share a few memes with you as they've been piling up, and I like to get these to you from time to time. Today's theme is Bitcoin and freedom, two topics that I'm obviously crazy about. The first one is from author and thought leader Jeff Booth, who says, quote, "All the noise is just a natural part of a slow and messy transition from a world of deception, fear, and scarcity to a world of truth, hope, and abundance, with every person understanding the transition at their own pace. Hashtag Bitcoin, the chaos only tells you how early you are," unquote. And I found a funny one with a Terminator theme. It had a young John Connor asking the Arnold Schwarzenegger character, "Did you come back to save the human race from machines?" In which the Terminator simply responds, "No, I'm here to buy Bitcoin on the cheap," unquote. Love it. And former U.S. Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard simply states this one, quote, "Bitcoin opens the door to freedom, opportunity, and individual empowerment," unquote. And one from one of my all-time heroes, the great George Carlin, who says, quote, "Sooner or later, the people in this country are going to realize that the government doesn't give a shit about them. Government doesn't care about you or your children or your rights or your welfare or your safety. It simply doesn't give a shit about you. It's only interested in its own power, keeping it and expanding it whenever possible," unquote. Oh, and lastly, from a humble Bitcoiner who says, "If you know someone that didn't take the jab and now they're telling you about Bitcoin, you should probably listen," unquote. Oh, man, I love it. My guest today is an Aussie who got up at the crack of dawn to meet with us. Let's go sit around the fire with him and speak the truth. Enjoy. Today's episode is brought to you by Stand Up Now Apparel. Stand Up Now has amazing designs centered on God, family, freedom, and patriotism. They use only the softest cotton in their designs and have gear for the whole family. There's something for everyone, Base Campers. I know you're going to love their products. Go support them at www.standupnowapparel.com and use the code BASECAMP to receive a 10% discount and free shipping. And now, on to our interview. My guest today is Daz B. Daz is an author, a musician, an electrician with qualifications in electrical engineering, a husband and father of two, and, of course, a Bitcoiner. Here is my interview with Daz B. All right, I am here with Daz B., author, Bitcoiner, futurist. I like to think of you as a futurist, Daz. Daz B., welcome to Base Camp for Men. It is great to have you on the show.
Absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for the invitation. Looking forward to our chat.
Absolutely. You know, and so you're way down in Australia. It's 5 a.m. Thanks for getting up early and having this chat with us. Where in Australia are you?
I'm in far north Queensland on the Great Barrier Reef where rainforest meets the reef. Beautiful spot.
Right on, right on. Well, and I first came across your name with the excellent book that you co-authored with Seb called B is for Bitcoin, The Essential Guide to All Things Bitcoin. And what a great book. I've been recommending it to all my friends who are, I feel like it's that perfect sweet spot of, I've heard of Bitcoin. I've heard of 21 million. I've clicked on one or two Michael Saylor. He's rapping about all kinds of stuff I probably don't understand all that well. So I know of Bitcoin. I'm a little bit curious, but I'm not really sure where to click or where to read next. And this book is like, it just fills in all these different blanks for the beginner. I think it takes people from a beginner's understanding to an intermediate pretty quickly. And it's just, you know, it's got private public key cryptography, what is self-custody, how the supply works in the halving, hashing, the role of miners and nodes, and including the protocol. So there's just all kinds of things. I think it's a great, great offering for the newbies. So great job on that before we get started.
Absolutely appreciate the feedback. It's really humbling to hear that people resonate with the book. And that was the intent, was to distill down what is otherwise a couple of hundred hours worth of research into what is actually Bitcoin, how does it work, how does it function, what's the history of it, and try and remove all of the complexity, all of the jargon, all the complex terminology, and just distill it down for everyday people.
That's great. Well, and mission accomplished on it. So I guess before we get really get rolling, just give us a sense of your background, where you grew up, what kind of work you've done, and how did you first get interested in Bitcoin? Was it clicking on videos? Was it a friend that was talking about it? Like, how did you yourself really start? And when was that?
Yeah, cool. So my background is a bit varied, actually. So I'm an electrician by trade, but prior to that, I spent over 10 years in sales and marketing, various roles. Quite a humble beginnings, humble family, youngest member of six kids. You know, parents who worked really hard, didn't earn a lot of money, very early valued the value of money. We didn't have a lot of it. So it was something that was always, you know, trying to hustle as a child, trying to accumulate. Very lucky beginnings, was provided for. Absolutely. Was given a lot of opportunities, studied music from a young age, which is something that stayed, with me my whole life, basically. So formally electrician by trade. So we call ourselves Sparky in Australia. And I've got formal engineering qualifications. So, electrical and electronics engineering. So I've got quite a bit of a technical background, and what that kind of set me up for success really is in Australia, in particular, us tradespeople, we earn quite a good wage. So I had some disposable income. And then I also do some side hustling. So I do a bit of music on the side. So I do just acoustic cover sessions at various pubs and clubs around where I live. So that's a nice little musical side hustle for us. So that meant I had a lot of disposable income. So I was looking to where to deploy that capital. And I was in a junction in my formal qualifications, in my formal studies, where I had a path to continue studying to one path, or I could take what was otherwise a very good wage at that point in time and start to funnel those energies that I was funneling into studying to try and understand investing. So I was doing about 20 hours of study a week. So rather than doing that formally through through a university in the engineering realm, I decided to do a bit of self-education in and around investing. So I gave myself a full year and I said, I'm going to absorb as much information, read as many books, watch as many podcasts, YouTube videos in and around finance and investing, and funnel those energies into that. What that led me down was a path I never sort of expected to go down. And this is really where I landed on Bitcoin, was from an investment lens, funnily enough, not so much from the technical and energy lens, which we can talk a bit about today. But where that sort of landed me was I got to a point where I was doing discount cash flow analysis to study equities. So what that basically means is you tear the lid off an equity, you look at their balance sheet, their cash flow statement, their balance, their income statements, and you can project out what a fair value for that stock would be. And to cut a long story short, this was circa 2019. And when you do discount cash flow analysis on the available stocks and equities that exist, and I don't care what market you're looking at, that could be Australia, US, Japan, what you quickly start to find is that a lot of stocks are trading upon multiples of what is otherwise considered fair value. Mm-hmm. And when you start digging down into that a little bit further, one of the main inputs that you see in there is interest rates. And then you dig a little bit deeper and then you discover that interest rates are manipulated and controlled through money printing. And that's a very long-winded way of saying that's how I come around to discovering Bitcoin.
Yeah, you know, it's – I kind of – less technical analysis, but I also came through it through investing as well. I've been an equity investor for 25 years and it just came across my radar. And I think MicroStrategy caught my attention. And I think I started down the Saylor Breedlove clicking, right? And I was like, what is this stuff? You know, and it's funny, Daz, that I had a friend, I want to say it was like 2013 or 2014. And he's like, he was talking all about Bitcoin and he's like, this thing's going to be huge. And I just could not get my mind around it at all. It was just, it sounded like a foreign language. And I was just like, tell me what it is, you know? And I was just like, I was such a noob. There was just no spark whatsoever. Even though I liked my friend and I respected him, I was like, he's off his rocker. Like, I don't know what he's talking about. How could this thing ever get that big? You know, and man, oh man, I don't know what it was priced at. It was a few hundred bucks, I think, a Bitcoin when he was talking about it. But you know, we've all had those stories of like, well, I first heard about it, you know, 5 years ago or whatever. And it just takes a while to mature. Some of it I think is divinely sparked in each person. Like I thank God every day that I got in and started to understand it during the pandemic when I was home twiddling my thumbs, and that I spent all those hours listening to really smart people talk about it, and that my wife gave me the thumbs up, that she's like, hey, you seem to have a really knack for this investing. So if you think it's really smart to do this, well, let's start stacking sats, you know? So, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's some real wisdom in what you've said there, and I think it's those touch points. And I do believe that you find it when you're ready to find it. You know, likewise, similar to your story, I think I first heard about it in 2015 from some people that were just complete degen gamblers in and around the workplace. And in a sense, I kind of thank myself that I wasn't my first touch point, because I don't know whether I was ready to receive the message the way that I was able to receive it had I dipped my toe in any earlier. And you know, that ICO craze, the initial coin offering craze in 2017, was the second touch point. Mm-hmm. And again, I was lucky. I wasn't in a financial position to roll the dice. Like every single dollar that I was craving at that point in time, it's no longer the dollar, it's the Bitcoin that I crave. But everything I was trying to hustle and accumulate was being used, because I had a young family. I was going through an apprenticeship. You know, there was a lot of financial stress on me. So I didn't actually have that disposable income to roll the dice. And I'm grateful for that, because had I got the gains through that whole craze, I don't know whether I would have gone back to really understanding the differences between Bitcoin and crypto.
You'd be a shit coiner if you made a whole bunch of money.
I may very well be. Right? And don't get me wrong, I did have my period of shit coining too through
me too,
early
me too.
2020. But I think with the macroeconomic backdrop around what was happening with the money printing, I think that really was the impetus for me to tear the lid off a little bit and just go that little bit deeper. And I think I was primed in 2020 to really fall down that rabbit hole. And I fell down really quite hard and it's just sort of consumed me. It's like, what the hell is this thing? So I, you know, and being, having a technical background as an electrical engineer, I tried to break it. I was like, this can't be true. With all of these things that they're telling me, there must be a flaw. There must be a way that this doesn't work. And the further I dug down that rabbit hole, the further it sucked me in, because I was coming to the realization that this thing is just incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what is it about the tradesmen? Because I swear, of the Bitcoiners I know in Seattle, two-thirds of them are tradesmen. It's like the fireman and the contractor and the carpenter. It's like, you guys, there's something about, they get it. I think maybe because a lot of tradesmen come from humble backgrounds and they're taught to hustle and work, you know. So the fireman I know, you know, he's a Bitcoiner. He's a contractor on his 5 days off. He's at the firehouse 2 days and he's just got his hustle on. He's got a young family and Bitcoin is super attractive to him, because he's like, hey, I feel like this is a way for me to save for my daughter. But I think the tradesmen, because of their hustle, I think they're more apt to understand it than somebody, you know. There's almost like these two realities, Daz. Like there's like what's emerging in the Bitcoin space, and people see it after they study it, and they really get excited and they understand it in a as clear as you can. It's an emerging field, so we're all just kind of in the second inning trying to figure out where this is going and what's happening with it and how to safely self-custody your coins and such. But I think I live in Seattle and it's saturated in technology. Amazon's here, Microsoft, it's fiat central. And a lot of people have done really well in the fiat system. And so they're not so hungry to understand a new paradigm of thinking about money, because they're close enough to the printer that it works well for them. They live in a big house and they're like, yeah, you know, private school is really expensive. And wow, I just spent, you know, 15 grand taking my family on vacation, but I'm making really good money. And so is my wife. So, you know, we're just going to ride this out. I think there's this sense, I don't know how it is in Australia. There's this sense of like, yeah, things are really expensive. Good thing I have a really good fiat job and I can afford it. And then over on this other side, you have this smaller portion of the population that is looking at Bitcoin and they're like, wow, this is a groundbreaking technology and I don't have to participate in the fiat mindset, in this scarcity, gotta keep, you know, making more, more, more always, you know. It's a little surreal. I don't know how it is for you. It's a little surreal sometimes when I look at it and compare the two, juxtapose the two mindsets. And I'm in the minority camp right now, but I'm in the camp that's not exhausted from this fiat like hamster wheel. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. So many things you said just then resonated with me. And I think just to go back to that, why do tradespeople understand? I think you hit it on the head. It's that like most tradespeople come from humble beginnings. You know, if you are the Ivy League type family, you get pushed into university type study and you end up in those types of roles, right? And that's where, you know, politicians are spawned. And there's a real and this is not to discount necessarily any of those types of working relationships at any stretch, but I think why tradespeople are so quick to get it is I think there's a fundamental you're close to work, like actual physical work, using your hands for work to turn that work into, you know, that is physical energy that you're then outlining to transfer into a monetary good. And I think that's where Bitcoin resonates with people quicker in that respect, is that it's closer to the proof of work, where if you're a sales or service industry, you're a layer removed from the actual physical hands-on, you know, and like factory work and all that sort of thing's been abstracted away through robotics. And we've ended up funneling a lot of society into these service type of roles. And that's not to say that people don't work hard in those roles. Please don't take anything away from those people, because they're absolutely on the hustle as well. But I think there's just if that makes sense, there's an abstracted layer removed from the actual physical when you're in those service types of roles. And that's really where, like you're saying yourself, Seattle's boomed, and it's all those service industries, right? Yep. It's all of the tech boom and all of that sort of thing. So we've gotten layers and layers and layers abstracted away from actual work, and I think that's really where the tradespeople are a bit closer to that, getting their hands dirty. And the other thing, really, you know, and this is why Looking Glass, like what we've created at Looking Glass, and why we wrote the book, is we really wanted to speak to wage earners, because what we're starting to notice is more and more people don't have the time or the bandwidth, because we're on this hamster wheel and we're in this hustle. And this hustle, because of our underlying purchasing power of the dollar that we're swapping our time and energy for, is losing purchasing power. We're having to spend more time at the hustle. We're having to spend more time at work, and we're getting less and less time to understand, to self-educate, to really lift yourself out of that hamster wheel. And that's really what we tried to create at Looking Glass. Like I realized that I was in a very fortunate position, having to be able to afford the time, the bandwidth, the energy to really study finance, economics. And I got to this point where I'm like, you know what, I'm an electrician. I shouldn't know how to do a discount cash flow analysis just to get ahead, just to keep off the hamster wheel.
Right.
So that's really what sparked the fire that lit the spark to start Looking Glass, to start bringing some of this education back to wage earners in language that people tend to resonate with outside of what's otherwise, you could argue, probably purposefully obscure, so that you have to rely on the experts within the field to be able to deploy your capital, you know. And this is really where, you know, us as humans, we've started to, at a subconscious level, understand that the money wasn't serving us. Mm-hmm. So we started to turn towards other things to store our value. And that's why everything's starting to attract a monetary premium, because our money is not money. Our fiat currency is not money. We can't save it and it appreciate in purchasing power. It's not how grandma used to describe money.
Yeah.
Grandma used to describe money as saving it. You could put it under your mattress back in the day, right? And come back and it would appreciate in purchasing power. Since 1971, we left the gold standard. Our money has been totally abstracted away from value, anything like tied to energy. So like us as humans now are really starting to struggle to navigate our world, because money is the communication medium between how we communicate value to each other. It's the base layer of what we settle on to communicate value. What you're selling, what I want to communicate is all basically settled in on this layer called money. And when you subconsciously know that money is losing purchasing power, you've got to turn towards other things. You might not be conscious that you're doing it, but that's what's ended up happening. And there's so much evidence to suggest that's what's happening. And that's how we end up with like massive real estate bubbles and property bubbles, because people are turning towards property as a pseudo savings vehicle.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember the light bulb going off for me during my learning process when I realized that college education hadn't gotten better, there was a reason it was costing $100,000, $150,000. It was the money was shit. It was the money had lost 97%. And that house that's not very nice next door that just sold for $800,000, it's probably worth $120,000 in actual value in the space. But it wasn't that the market, you know, you could say, well, like normies would say, well, that the market will pay that. But the light bulb really went off for me when I realized, you know what? It's that the U.S. dollar has been so debased that it takes that many to buy that little crappy house, that little tool shed. It takes $850,000 or whatever because the money's no good. The money has no value. They're just tossing it. They're just printing more of it, and the value keeps going down. And I always find it so interesting that it's actually counterintuitive. And I've said this on other podcasts when I've done them on Bitcoin. It's counterintuitive because you think, well, the Fed can print all the money that they want, so there's enough for everybody. It's kind of like a common sense way of thinking about it, but you're not drilling down into it. The more they print, the less it's worth. And people on the flip side of that think, well, there's only 21 million Bitcoin. There's not enough to go around, but it's actually the inverse of that. It's worth more and more and more, and it's more valuable over time. It's like this paradox that you have to get your mind around, because it's not intuitive at first glance. You think, oh, there's only 21 million. There's not enough for me. And, oh, they're printing all this money. That's good for all of us, right? That's kind of the conventional way of thinking it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. And I think, you know, at its fundamental layer, this is why I'm so passionate about Bitcoin education, because I think at its fundamental layer, at first glance, we see Bitcoin and it looks really complicated. It looks really, you know, obscure. It's hard to understand. We've got all these technical terms, you know, like what we wrote in Beers for Bitcoin, like private public key cryptography and decentralization and all this terminology that seems really, really complex. But at its fundamental layer, it's bringing a really easy investment savings vehicle back to everyday people. You really don't need to understand what's under the hood. Like, and there's plenty of good analogies with that. Like, you know, I can send you an email. I don't need to know how the protocol works on the back end of the email. I just know that it works, right? And that's really where I think we're going to get to over the next couple of cycles with Bitcoin, is this, I guess, acceptance of not needing to know what's under the hood. However, because it's so volatile in the short term, you really do yourself a favor to really dig down into the weeds to get a fundamental understanding, because then it becomes a really, really easy and simple investment vehicle. You work hard, you know, spend less than you make, you save the excess in Bitcoin over the long term, and you come back in 4 years and you look at what it's done. That's as simple as it needs to be. And then if you have a bit of a fundamental understanding around what's under the hood, you can ignore all of the negative news press, all the negative news articles, all the negative media in and around why it's boiling the oceans and it's doing all these things. All you need to do then is look under the hood and say, is my node still running? Look at mempool.space. Is that block still, you know, every 10 minutes on average. Is there anything, you know, look at the hash rate of the mining, which is all publicly available. You can look under the hood very easily and say, there's nothing fundamentally wrong with Bitcoin as a whole. So I can ignore all of the short-term volatility. I can ignore that 20% price drawdown in US terms that we've just experienced in the last, you know, X amount of days, whatever the case may be. It's a really quite a simple savings technology to look under the hood and say, nothing's broken. I'll come back in 4 years.
That's great. That is a brilliant way of looking at it. I feel like that's the takeaway right there. That way you just said the last few minutes, that's it. You know, one of the things I'm so interested in, the aspect of Bitcoin, how Bitcoin, the culture that's growing up around Bitcoin. You know, I'm in Seattle. There's not a lot of action yet, you know, so I have to look on forums and I see people talking about what's going on with Bukele in El Salvador and all these different pockets and the conferences all over the world. But one of the things that I really, really love about Bitcoin's culture that's emerging is this, all this optimism. Like, it's like people, it's a freedom technology, a freedom money. It's empowering. And people are just so excited about what they're building, the businesses they're building, all the decentralized applications that are happening around the world with all the developers. And for me, I'm a natural born optimist, so I am attracted to an optimistic culture, right? I find that to be where I optimize myself. I can contribute the most in that environment rather than a scarcity environment or one where we're getting hammered by fear, you know, like all the ways that we've had to kind of operate under the fiat banksters and the globalists with their agenda. You know, we've survived. I don't know if I would say that humanity has thrived under those systems. So to me, it's really intoxicating to see a parallel development that is pro-humanity, for humans, and there's all these great people that are building on it, spreading the word, writing books like you did. To me, I feel kind of honored and privileged to be part of a new tribe that is excited to build something that's not going to enslave humanity, is not going to create, you know, just all the different grift and corruption that we see as a result of the money printing and the fiat system and the fiat consciousness. So I see it kind of as a you know, there's a spiritual awakening happening in humanity, and Bitcoin is running right along with humans saying, hey, learn about this because it's really going to help you save, but also exchange. And there's going to be a bunch of cool things that emerge out of this culture. And yes, it is optimistic for a reason. So I just wanted to ask you, just share that with you. And what are you noticing about the culture of Bitcoin? You're immersed in it yourself. Like I said, I don't see much in Seattle. I'm kind of a little bit of a lone wolf here so far, but I'm plugged into different, you know, Noster and Telegram. And I find my Bitcoiners that way, but I just wanted to share that with you and the listeners, and that, you know, the culture is really uplifting and I find that super attractive.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, we've got quite a humble little meetup in and around. So I live in a town of about 150,000 people, and we've got members, a meetup group that we meet once every 4 weeks, and we've got about 30 members. So it's you know, not huge numbers, but what's really key to that, I think, is they're just really, really good humans. And I don't know particularly what it is about Bitcoin. I've got a few thoughts in and around why I think possibly that's true. But really, like, it's a cliche and it's overused, I believe, this saying, but Bitcoin really is hope. And if I can tear the lid off that a little bit and just dig into that, why I think that actually is I think to have understood Bitcoin at this point, there's a fair degree of self-motivation and self-drive that is required for you to understand it. So what it's inevitably done is attracted people with that same thought and same mindset in and around self-motivation. So there's a real draw for attracting that type of mentality. Now, what I think Bitcoin ultimately does for people is it's an enabling technology. It's providing everyday people optionality. and optionality toward people who wouldn't have otherwise not had an opportunity to be able to express themselves under a fiat system, because we're on the grind. We weren't born into privilege. We weren't born into wealth, you know, humble beginnings. But what Bitcoin's really starting to do is these people who have really deep motivations, real deep self-drive, see the world in a particular way in and around proof of work and all of these concepts, are starting to really obtain through the accruing of purchasing power, obtaining optionality. And I don't know if you're familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but it's this system whereby you've got a base layer of pure human survival. You need food, shelter, water, all of those things. Once they're covered, you can start to move up this pyramid, and at the top is self-actualization. So what we're seeing is people actually being able to exercise what they were put here to do, what really resonates with them. And then what is proliferating from that is really a beautiful way of seeing the world. Mm-hmm. And we're attracting people who see the world in very similar ways. And the optionality is actually allowing us to build that out in real time. And that is a self-reinforcing mechanism. It's a feedback loop that's attracting more people, because they're looking at their friend who all of a sudden is able to pull their kids out of school and spend really quality time traveling around Australia, for example, for 12 months. And they're going, I want that for me. What is it about him that has enabled him to be able to spend all this quality time with his children? Maybe I should understand what enabled that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a good point. You know, quality of life, getting off the hamster wheel. You know, I've heard a lot of people, there's this, I don't even want to say it's a divide. It's just kind of two ways that I've heard it expressed, that, you know, really Bitcoin store of value is its main component. It's its main value proposition, right? And that's plenty. In all the things we've talked about is Bitcoin as a store of value. But I've also heard a camp that's saying that the store of value may not even be the main component, that it's spawning this kind of decentralization that could revolutionize how we do everything, healthcare, politics, you name it. The decentralization and using protocols that are not attached to a central authority or a central node could be something that sweeps through every single aspect of the way that we do things. And I'm never quite sure. You know, Saylor, I think when you listen to him, he's really like, it's store of value. Like, you don't overthink it. That's what it is. It's, you know, keep it simple. That's what we're talking about. But then, you know, you read like Jason Lowry's Soft War, or you read any of the articles where people are sort of extrapolating what may occur out of this decentralized way of seeing the world. And you could see that the revolution could go beyond a store of value. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on that. Both are interesting to me. Obviously, the first thing was the store of value, and it's still probably the central heartbeat and component of why I'm in that community. But I'm also looking on the horizon of going, what else are they going to build? Because Pandora's box has been open, and we don't need to have centrally controlled X in this, you know, industry or that industry. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. I think to touch on the first sort of point around the store of value, I think that's what is fundamentally needed to attract people to the first place.
I agree.
We come for number go up, because that's what we're all on this hamster wheel trying to appreciate our purchasing power, whether that's, you know, through investing or whatever. So it's fundamentally the store of value that brings people in. But I think, like, to Saylor's point where he just says it's just a store of value, I think he's just a very clever chess player.
Yeah.
I think if he were to publicly come out, he's trying to, you know, enable the acknowledgement and the acceptance of Bitcoin as the treasury asset for companies. And I think if he were to come out and overtly threaten the US dollar, that just sends the wrong message to the people that he speaks to. So I think it's a very clever thing on his behalf by just saying it's just store of value. Where if you're in Bitcoin for a period of time, and this is something that I reflected on maybe in the last 2 years, is at some point I wasn't really conscious of the shift, but at some point I started denominating everything in Bitcoin. And that's really where it evolved for me. It's an evolution, I think. I came for the store of value, but then it really started to be the unit of account for me, where I started to convert everything into Bitcoin terms. For example, we were going to go on an overseas holiday. And just in the period of the cycle and in the bit of the bear market, I started denominating that expense in Bitcoin terms. And I was like, honey, you know, to my wife, if we waited for this trip, and don't get me wrong, I'm all for using the purchasing power to enable the things that you want in life. That's why we're all here. So I'm not saying by any stretch, like, never go on a holiday. But by the same token, I started to denominate it in Bitcoin terms. I said, maybe that holiday is just mistimed. Maybe we can have a much better holiday, or, you know, if we just, you know, abstain from that gratification now and we put it back another 18 months, and maybe that opens up a whole lot of new options. So I started denominating those types of things, like a car, a house, you know, real estate, everything starts to get denominated in Bitcoin terms. I'm like, holy crap, that's like 3 Bitcoin, you know, for, you know, all of these types of things. So that's really where the shift was for me. And then I think medium of exchange, again, then starts to become the more that you grow community, the more that actually does become a medium of exchange. Like, I honestly do use Bitcoin to transact probably at least once a week. And then I have some weeks that are more intense than others. But, you know, when we have our little meetups, we're starting to build a community of services, of skill sets, that I would way rather pay a Bitcoiner some sats to come and do some work for me than go out and seek that in the fiat world. And it's about building out this circular economy with Bitcoin. And a lot of people say, oh, how could you ever spend Bitcoin? Like, you know, that tinting on your car that you paid X amount of sats for is going to be worth, you know, $10,000 in 5 years' time. But what's important in that is to spend and replace. I was always going to expend the fiat. So I would rather build out the circular economy and encourage that existence by spending the sats now, going straight back onto the exchange, sending fiat back to it. And just excuse me for a second, I just got a cough.
No, you're good.
It's been a little bit under the weather. But, I would rather spend on the day and replace that straight away so that I'm not out of sats, and I've just helped more sats into circulation within that economy. And what's really important, I think, to reflect on is that all of these things feed back on themselves. Mm-hmm. So the store of value, which drew us here in the first place, store of value is one real feature that will, that will attract X amount of capital into the space. Unit of account will then invariably also attract a certain amount of capital into the space. And these aren't a summative equation. They're exponential equations, which means that they will self-multiply on top of each other. So it's not like we're saying store of value is worth $20 trillion eventually, and then unit of account might be worth another $10 trillion. It's not saying that that's now worth $30 trillion. It's not a summation. It's actually an exponential function. So what we're actually, you know, it's quite plausible to think, and this is, I owe this sort of thinking to my good friend Peter Dunworth, who I strongly suggest anyone in the audience go and have a listen. He's a brilliant mind in traditional finance who come up with this idea around this being an exponential function. So what it actually means is that each of these store of value, unit of account, medium of exchange, whatever that means in terms of market cap and capitalization, it's going to be a multiplier. So we're not saying it's 20 trillion plus the 10 trillion. It's going to be 20 trillion potentially times 10 trillion. And what that does for price at the margin is it's going to suck in all of the capital out of all of these assets that have drawn a monetary premium. So it's not to say that it's going to reprice things that have true value. Like, Apple stock will always be worth something because it actually provides value. But what it will do is suck out the monetary premium that it's otherwise attracted, above what would otherwise be considered its fair value. And I think where it's really going to be obvious is real estate.
Yeah, I was listening to another Bitcoiner who's also a real estate investor, and he said the exact same thing. He's like, right now, if I was, you know, for the young people looking to get into real estate, I would sock your store of value in Bitcoin and think of real estate more as for the utility of it, not as a store of value. He goes, I just feel like there's a good chance you're gonna get rugged in real estate right now, is what he was saying in the West, right? So it's interesting. Anything you want to say about that, about the real estate thing?
Well, I would just add there that I don't think for, young people who don't come from privilege, your only option to acquire a place to live that is yours will be through Bitcoin.
Yep. Yep.
You cannot even save enough for a deposit.
Yep.
Because
I agree.
The money printer is running away from your ability to store savings in order to even obtain a deposit for that house. And that is such a god-awful thought. And really what the important part is if you can accumulate Bitcoin over a long enough period of time, you'll be able to pay cash for that. It might be four cycles and you're renting, but you've got no choice anyway. You've got to rent, right?
Yeah.
You've got to have somewhere to live. But what it will open up is optionality for you to choose wherever the hell you want to live. Like, you know, it enables you to pick up and reassess. Like a lot of people, like, I don't know what Seattle real estate's like, right?
Oh, but
a lot
of people get brutally high. Yeah.
and people like might not even resonate with Seattle, but you're stuck on the hamster wheel. You can't even afford to move.
Exactly.
You know, because it's quite a large expense to pick up all your possessions, all your worldly belongings and shift them to a jurisdiction that's better, right? But Bitcoin, it's this digital nomad thesis that's playing out through a book that was written in the 90s called The Sovereign Individual. They predicted this in the 90s to say there will be jurisdictional arbitrage between, you know, what is best serving people. And digital currency like Bitcoin, a scarce digital asset, is going to be the enabler to lift people out of this funk and give them options to say, this is no longer serving me. This city is no longer serving me. This real estate market's no longer serving me. This job market's no longer serving me. And it's amazing. Like sometimes I just sit there and think, God, how lucky are we that we discovered this?
Yeah. Are you noticing here, one of the dynamics I'm seeing too is I'm seeing the emergence of Bitcoin and the nomadic culture. It's leading people to leave the cities. They want to live out where the nature, where they've got space, maybe buy some land, like, you know, like have a garden, like all the things that maybe, you know, were opposite. My generation, we all moved into big cities. That's where the work was. That's where the excitement was, the nightlife. That's where you might meet your wife. You know, I mean, that's the cities were where that's where it was. And now I'm seeing the opposite. It's like almost this exodus out because the cities are so expensive and they've gone to shit. You know, it's like crime's really bad and people don't feel as safe in the cities and it's just super pricey. And, you know, you can work remotely and you can do other things and it's cheaper out there there's a big, big, big world and you don't have to live in these expensive, unsafe, ridiculous cities in small apartments. You can start to store your life force and your energy in Bitcoin. And that's just going to open up, particularly for the young people. I saw this email the other day that said that depression is off the charts with millennials. And they cited all the things you and I have been talking about. It's so expensive. They're coming out of college with a lot of debt if their parents didn't pay for the whole thing. They're looking at jobs that, you know, if they're not in the tech sector, may probably are not going to, you know, afford them the lifestyle to be able to buy their own house and start a family in some place. And the whole thing leads to kind of like this depression and malaise. And who can blame millennials for feeling that way, given that that the cards are so stacked against them economically. And then here comes this bright sun, this bright orange Bitcoin sun emerging on the horizon. It's like that is going to be a game changer if you'll learn about it and embrace it. And so for me, it's a no-brainer for the young people. Like just start to stack your sats. You're going to get happier. You won't be depressed as you start to put some of your life force in that savings vehicle. You're going to be able to have the lifestyle that you're kind of thinking of in your mind's eye.
Yeah, it's a really interesting dynamic. And I think there's a gentleman named Brandon Quidham, I think, wrote a paper in and around this thought process of Bitcoin enabling more for us as humans to spread out a little bit wider. And I guess like it pays to just think a little bit about history in and around why cities actually exist. And it was normally around the ability for transport, like ports, hubs, and energy centers. Mm-hmm. And I think what really the opportunity for for this to be flipped on its head, isn't it, around Bitcoin being this ultimate transfer layer between energy and a monetary good. Mm-hmm. We've never had a monetary good directly tied to energy, like and without sort of going, I guess, too deep in the weeds in this pod, in and around how Bitcoin's actually come about. It's directly tied to expensive energy. Mm-hmm. And what that enables is for us to, and this is what I do sort of from day-to-day job, right, as I work on the utility grid. I'm intimately familiar with this idea in and around transferring electrons to people who consume them. And I guess that's where cities have really started to proliferate, because of your access to energy has been so much easier in cities. And I think what is a really interesting dynamic is the fact that Bitcoin will enable us to be able to harness and capitalize energy centers outside of traditional locations, traditional norms in and around transmission grids. So it actually enables you to expend some capital to harness energy in otherwise unprofitable regions. And what that then enables you to do is directly tie the cost of that capitalization to harness that energy into a monetary good, which can then be reinforced back into building out energy grids. And we're seeing this all through Africa as a real a real powerful example of the enablement of being able to tap into that energy center and monetize that. So there's a company there called Gridless who's partnering with some energy providers, some hydroelectric providers, and where it's been unprofitable to build out grids in the past for a lot of these sort of, for want of a better term, mud hut villages, we're basically enabling a profit sharing model with those energy generators to say, hey, let us park some of these Bitcoin miners on site. Let us directly monetize that wasted and excess energy into dollars, and we can reinvest and we can profit share, and you can reinvest those dollars back into the community to build our grids. That same thing, I firmly believe, will play out in the developed world as well. We'll just be slower to adopt it. They've got a real need, a real drive to do it. But I think what we're going to actually see is that those, the traditional interconnected through a whole country or a whole state, whole region transmission network won't be as needed in the future, because we don't need to send electrons from one side of the country to the other, because we can actually harness them, trap them, and convert them into a monetary good on the spot where we generate them. And what that will enable is for more energy centers and more cities and more towns to start being built up in areas that were otherwise never going to be connected because they can't get a connection to the grid. Does that make a bit of sense? I might pause there and allow for some questions.
Oh, yeah, that definitely makes sense. And it's exciting to, because you hear a lot about the first take was like, oh, Bitcoin's bad for the environment, right? Remember that? The smear of, people should avoid this. It's bad for the environment. The old climate change, it's wasteful. It uses too much energy, was what you heard. So it's a great counter argument, and that there's like rubber meets the road in developing nations that need, that need efficient energy and need to be have money coming in and value coming in, right? It's like it's a great value proposition in these different. I've kind of seen some things out of Africa. It's really interesting to me as that develops. Obviously, the El Salvador thing was groundbreaking. Like I still can't believe I've seen that turnaround happen so fast. And I'm really looking, I don't know if you've been there. I'm really looking forward to going there. People that I talk to that are normies are like, why would you want to go there? But all the Bitcoiners are like, oh yeah, I can't wait to get down there. Just because I've never seen a community embrace Bitcoin like they have in El Salvador and Bitcoin Beach there and Bukele. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what kind of 2.0 in Bitcoin looks like. Like with El Salvador, it's a small enough country that I think you could see kind of the impact it's having on the population and the nation in a fairly short time frame compared to where they were. I mean, they were the murder capital of the world, not, just a few years ago, really. I'm looking forward to traveling to some places where it's a little bit in the next phase, just to kind of get a glimpse of the future and see how it's impacting the people and the culture and the businesses and seeing what they're doing down there. I don't know if you've been to El Salvador or not, but
I have not. It's on the to-do list. And it's just a masterclass in what Bitcoin can enable for a country, right? We've been speaking a lot about what it can enable for people, but there's all of these other layers, what it can enable for a company, what it can enable for a local government. We're seeing this country with Bukele just doing this masterclass in Bitcoin enablement for that country. And, you know, it's tapping into energy, it's providing an alternative to the IMF. They were heavily dependent on loans and that's just a diabolical. There's plenty of examples of how that does not serve a lot of these developing countries, with them, you know, completely changing their economics and their agricultural base, their industrial bases, just to serve these loans. It's an absolutely deplorable example. And Bukele's just flipping this on his head. And I just noticed, I don't know if you saw this news press, he's just opened up or just announced that he's opening up 5,000 visas to attract talent into the country. So that's, you know, engineers, philosophers, doctors, scientists. It's really trying to come to my country. If you've got, you know, if you've taken the time to go and do a degree and you've got these very specific skills that we need to build out an even better country, please come here. It's that thesis from that book, The Sovereign Individual, playing out in real time. It's like he's reading that as the playbook and pulling off a masterclass. And I can't wait to get there myself. I was very lucky enough to go to Madeira last month to the Bitcoin Affairs conference. That was to a lesser degree. Bitcoin's really starting to proliferate there. I mean, there's businesses accepting it. It had a real lovely vibe to it, and it's just a small glimpse of what a Bitcoin standard can enable for a small country.
Beautiful, beautiful. Well, Daz, thanks so much for coming on Basecamp Freeman. Tell us about the work you're doing at Looking Glass Education. I have clicked around on there. It is super great, great resources for people wanting to learn more about Bitcoin. The people that are just now starting to go, huh, I've heard it now two or three times. Where can I learn more? Looking Glass, super great resource. And just tell us where people can find your great book, B is for Bitcoin, that we've been talking about, and anything else you'd like our listeners to know about.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for the opportunity. So B is for Bitcoin is available through self-publishing through Amazon. So highly encourage you. It's available on Kindle and printed format. There's links on lookingglasseducation.com if you can't find it. And just importantly as well, like, we never wanted price to become a barrier to what we see as very critical education. So B is for Bitcoin, funnily enough, is actually part two of our free course that you can find on Looking Glass Education. So if you can afford the sats, we'd absolutely love the support for you to buy the book, because it helps us provide more education to everybody. But if you can't, absolutely, that education is there. So we've kind of gone through a bit of a rebrand in the last few months. So we've have a two-part course that is now one giant course called the Bitcoin course. Part two of that is the book Beers for Bitcoin in all its glory. The first part of it is in and around why you might want to consider Bitcoin as a hard wage earning person. We very much frame up the history of money, the byproducts of a fiat monetary system on you as a wage earner, and what are your investable options? What does real estate look like in the future? What does gold look like? What does equities look like? What are bonds? You know, most people don't understand what a bond is, so it's a little bit on explaining what that is. And then finally, why Bitcoin, I think, really needs to be a part of everybody's investment portfolio. And then obviously part two is Beers for Bitcoin, around if you're going to own it, you need to, or we touched on this a bit earlier, you need to just do a little bit of work on the fact that you need to understand what it is and how it works. So that's the part two. One of the most critical things for Bitcoin is taking self-custody. Do not leave it on an exchange. There's a whole host of risks involved in leaving Bitcoin on an exchange, where you buy it, where you store it. So if you need help with that, we can do initial consults for free. Happy to open that up to your listeners. If you need to have a chat about what custody is, by all means, reach out. That's through our custody service on there as well. And we've got a whole host of different options we can explore to find the best custody solution for your personal circumstance.
Beautiful. Well, Daz, thanks so much for getting up early and spending time with us. Super great to chat with you. I just really appreciate your time and you coming on, sharing your insight, your wisdom. Come back anytime. It's just great to spend time with you.
It's an absolute pleasure, Tony.
Well, I hope you enjoyed our time with Daz as much as I did. To up your understanding of Bitcoin and start to turn a corner on it, go get Daz's great book that he co-authored titled B is for Bitcoin, available on Amazon. Like I said, it fills this sweet spot for new Bitcoiners, taking you from noob into a more intermediate understanding of many of the important aspects of the protocol and why each is important. And also a great resource for you to better understand Bitcoin is www.lookingglasseducation.com. They have courses and deep dives to help the new and experienced Bitcoiner alike better understand this game-changing technology. Thank you, Base Campers, and we'll see you around the fire next week. If you find value in our show and wish to show us some love, we are now making that very easy to do. You simply go to www.basecampformen.com and click on Donate Support Basecamp. You'll find an easy way to make either monthly donations for as little as $5 a month, or you can donate just once. We love the monthly donation and hope to build this up over the coming months, but any show of support is greatly appreciated, honestly. Thank you for your support and for helping to keep Basecamp as a resource on your hero's journey. That's our show for today. Thank you for listening. Men, good luck in all your endeavors, and good luck on your hero's journey. This is Tony Rezac, and you're listening to Basecamp for Men.